It was almost as though I felt that my moment to live had come. The only reality was the next 200 yards of track under my feet. The arms of the world, as it were, waiting to receive me. I leapt at the tape, like a man taking his last spring to save himself from a chasm that threatened to swallow him up. I knew that I'd done it without hearing the time.
May 1954, the young English medical student Roger Bannister breaks the four-minute mile at Oxford. On RN, this is The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith. As breaking the four-minute barrier for the mile was the great athletic quest of the mid-20th century, so it's now to run the marathon in under 2 hours and for it to be done drug-free.
Throughout history, we've always been wrong about what the limits of the human body are. Before the four-minute mile was broken, there were many intelligent people who said it wasn't possible. Well, it was possible.
Ed Caesar is the author of 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon.
We can only see sport and, in fact, human achievement through the prism of our own experience. So whatever we're experiencing now, it's very hard to see beyond that and to project sensibly what might be possible in the future. But history tells us that human beings progress, technology progresses, training progresses, and the world moves on fast once these barriers are broken.
That was certainly the case with the four-minute mile. After Roger Bannister broke it in May 1954, the great Australian runner John Landy did it, faster again, in June that year. Then in August, the two of them competed at the Commonwealth Games in Vancouver in what was dubbed the Mile of the Century.
Landy, in his green shorts for Australia, slim, sallow, curly dark hair, and he's setting out a very fast pace.
The whole focus was on this race. It was being swept up in a sort of a frenzy of interest because of this Mile of the Century, so-called.
That's John Landy recalling the global excitement that surrounded this race.
At the bell. And still, it's Landy in the lead, with Bannister 2 yards behind.
It's been one of the most remarkable seasons ever. There has been one of those great leaps forward.
And that's another runner, Chris Chataway, who was one of Roger Bannister's pacemakers at Oxford, speaking in 1954.
And Bannister breaks the tape now, and Landy second about 3 yards behind.
After that, if you couldn't run a mile in under 4 minutes, you weren't in the race. But can the same sort of thing happen with the marathon?
We hope that we can break this barrier within 5 years.
That's sports scientist and anti-doping researcher Yiannis Pitsiladis. He heads up the Sub 2 Hours Marathon Project, involving scientists, athletes and sponsors in this quest. The current world record for the marathon is just under 2 hours and 3 minutes, set in Berlin last year.
The line approaches. Watch the clock now. He's smashed the world record. He's smashed the 2 hours, 3 minutes barrier. He's the champion in 2014. 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds for Denis Kimeto.
Impressive, but that still means there's a way to go before anyone gets under the 2 hour mark. Yiannis Pitsiladis has a timeline some might think optimistic.
As soon as possible, within the 5 year period is our goal.
So what will be involved in achieving this, the sort of specific areas of research and training?
The first, let's say, goal is to create this international consortium. So the first months, all I've done is trying to get the world's best scientists working in the areas that we think are going to be important, to get them to interact, set up the specialist facilities we require, both in Ethiopia and Kenya, which are our two areas of focus, get the funding in place. You know, the problems we've been facing up until now, the major sponsors from around the world who have been really interested in the project have been saying, well, this sounds too unbelievable, you know, to actually be prepared to give us the kind of money we require. So that's been one of the issues.
Well, back in 1981, Rob de Castella, the Australian marathoner, he ran a world record time of 2:08.18. The current world record is held by Denis Kimeto, his time 2:02.57. So that's 5 minutes and 21 seconds faster over those 33 years. You're now aiming to shave 3 more minutes off the world record in 5 years. That's surely very ambitious.
It certainly is, but I would say that the last few world records, which have been broken by East Africans, have been done with no scientific input. And I really mean none, besides the stopwatch, and that's not too scientific in itself. So these records have been achieved, leaving the athletes to their own devices. I'll use an example of the world record that I was involved with, or my team was, and that was the Berlin Marathon, where Haile Gebrselassie broke the world record. And in the weeks leading up to that marathon, we were invited to assist the athlete. I was so surprised that if we weren't there, the athlete was literally doing what all his predecessors had been doing for decades. So the whole aim now is, well, okay, if this was achieved, what happens if we are to instigate a scientific approach, which actually looks at all of the components that are going to be required? I think it just makes so much sense that we can achieve this.
A key aim, as I understand it, of the sub-2-hour marathon project is that the runners have to be drug-free. Now, given the recent revelations about hundreds and hundreds of suspicious blood tests of elite endurance athletes over the decade 2001 to 2012, how are you going to ensure the athletes that get involved in your marathon project are clean?
This is a very much an anti-doping project, and the way we are hoping to ensure that it's a clean project is by adopting the current approaches that have been implemented by WADA. But this project is a WADA plus project. We will also be instigating our own anti-doping processes. So when we invite elite athletes to join this project, we are also very, very clear that they sign up to this WADA plus process, because we have to be absolutely sure that the athletes are clean and are running clean. But it'll probably self-select. Any athlete that is involved in doping will clearly not want to participate in this program.
But you're also hoping, intending this project will, in a way, assist in the fight against doping in sport?
Absolutely. We have to start thinking out of the box. The approaches that have been used have really not produced the result that we want, which is clean sport. And we have to think differently.
And it would be a powerful message, wouldn't it? Reduce the incentive to cheat by demonstrating other legal ways to improve performance. This is The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith. The first Olympic marathon in 1896 was won in just under 3 hours, and that was astonishing at the time. Ed Caesar, the author of 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon, says it was 100 years later that the idea started to form that going under 2 hours was possible.
People have been interested in the 2-hour marathon for quite a long time, even when it was pretty far away. But really it crystallised, in the scientific community at least, when a young medical student called Mike Joyner, who now works at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, when he was an undergraduate, he wrote a groundbreaking study which posited that the fastest possible time for the perfect athlete in the best conditions was 1:57:58 for the marathon. And that told people that the 2-hour marathon was possible, in theory at least. It was 1986 when he started writing that, and it was only 1991 when he got it published. And that was really the starting point in the debate that still rages on in the scientific community today.
Well, until May 1954, everyone said a sub 4-minute mile was impossible, didn't they? And then Roger Bannister did it, and then John Landy did it, and then lots of people did it. How does that happen?
Well, John Landy, every time he tried to break the 4-minute mile, he wound up 2 or 3 seconds short or long, depending on how you count it.
Yeah.
And he would say, it's a brick wall. Well, when Bannister broke the record, almost the next thing that Landy did was go and run 3:58. So obviously it was a brick wall only in his head. Now, there are limits to the human body, and in every event, there's got to be some kind of upper threshold of what's possible, clean at least. But certainly 4 minutes was not a barrier. It was just something that had been built up in people's heads. And I think as we get closer to 2 hours, there's going to be a big debate about whether it's possible to do it. And that debate will mirror, to some extent, the four-minute mile debate. But I've got no doubt in my head that one day some extraordinarily talented person will breast the tape in under 2 hours.
Now, you say that over the past 10 years, the sport of marathon running has been remade. It's no longer regarded by the top runners as a pure endurance event. Tell me more.
You know, in my head, two runners really changed the marathon. One was Haile Gebrselassie from Ethiopia, who really put his mind to how to break records in a more efficient way. So he went really fast for the first half and tried to maintain an even pace all the way to the end. Before that, marathons had been seen as pure endurance. If you could just hang on until the final couple of miles and then you could maybe make your move, that was how you won a race. Whereas, you know, the elite marathon is really a very delicate exercise in spreading your energy over the whole race. And then Sami Wanjiru, who won the 2008 Olympic marathon, really pioneered an approach which was highly aggressive and hadn't really been seen before, which was that you just went as hard as you could from the start and dared everyone to follow you. And now I think those approaches are seen as sort of quite normal. You know, people are extremely aggressive in the marathon in a way that they weren't 10 years ago.
The research that the Sub-2-Hour Project, headed by Yiannis Pitsiladis, is concentrating on includes analysing running economy, developing biomarkers to evaluate training and nutrition.
Already we've conducted a number of studies looking at the diet that will be required to run a sub-2 marathon. We know, for example, that the human body is designed to store carbohydrate, but there isn't enough carbohydrate to get to the end of the marathon. The marathon distance is a little bit too far, so we've got to try and find ways to efficiently utilize fuel to get us to the end of the race as quickly as possible.
How enthusiastic are athletes about this project?
It's an interesting question because most of the interest has come from athletes outside the African region. But that was the case up until a few months ago. What has happened in the last few months has been our activity in Ethiopia in particular, but also some activity in Kenya, where some of the world's greatest distance runners have been involved in our initial studies and have been so impressed with the technology that we've been using, and in particular, dealing with some of the major problems which relate to injury. Some of the best athletes are limited, not necessarily from the point of view of performance issues, but more from the point of view of not having the right treatment for injuries. And so in the last few months, we've been very much working closely with some of these athletes to help them return to training. And I'd argue that has really enthused them, so much so that I was finding in my recent trip in Ethiopia that in the first days, you know, we had the odd athlete visiting us. By the time I was leaving, the hotel lobby was full of some of the greatest athletes in Ethiopia wanting to take part in the project.
The marathon, of course, is not just an event for top runners competing for big money and ever faster times. The city marathons like Berlin, Boston, London, they've also become a very popular thing for ordinary mortals to do. And Ed Caesar, what was it that Chris Brasher, who as a runner was instrumental in the 4 minute mile, what was it that he said about the London Marathon?
Yeah, he called it, and I love this phrase, he called it the Great Suburban Everest. And I think that's a really beautiful way of putting it. If you're, you know, 60 years old and out of shape, you can kind of lick yourself into a bit of shape and run a marathon, and you're not going to break the world record, and you probably won't break 4 hours, but you can get to the end of it. And Geoffrey Mutai can stand on the start line and try and get there in 2:04. And, you know, your 60-year-old can try and get there in 5:04. So it's the same race. They're all starting on the same starting line. It's very democratic that way. It's a race that has been embraced by so many people because it's become a metaphor for endurance as well as the actual act itself.
But I wonder if the participatory nature of it means that the marathon has lost a little bit of its luster, that is sort of revived by the allure of a 2-hour time pending somewhere in the future.
Yeah, I think the elite sport's really forgotten how to sell itself. You know, when you see the TV coverage of a big marathon, most of the time will be spent on the guy dressed as St. George who's running with a dragon all the way back in the field.
Yes, and, the ones dressed as superheroes. And
exactly,
so on.
Yeah. Exactly. Because people have kind of lost interest in this flock of mostly East African men at the front of fields. you know, part of the reason why I wrote 2 hours was to try and recapture that sense of wonder. You know, I knew that these people at the front of the field were extraordinary human beings with extraordinary stories. But what you see is that elite marathon runners have very short windows at the top of their sport in which to really prove themselves. And because they only run 2 big marathons a year, you know, the number of opportunities they get to really, really run fast is very small. So, you know, for me, that really enhances the interest in the sport. One shot, one opportunity. When you race in Berlin at the peak of your career, are you going to break the world record or aren't you?
All right. So now tell me about the moonshot marathon.
Yeah, well, this is just an idea that gets kicked about and is especially in the air now as we're approaching 2 hours. The way that the marathon circuit is set up at the moment, people run in, you know, the biggest marathons in the world, which are Berlin, London, Chicago, New York, Boston, and Tokyo. Those are the 6 biggest marathons in the world in terms of money and in terms of prestige. And on only one of them, really, is the world record possible. That's in Berlin. Because of the conditions where it's very flat, beautifully cold and bright and not very windy. So that's very helpful for the world record. I mean, you might be able to break it in Chicago too. And London's an outside shot, but forget about it in New York and Boston doesn't count. So if you could somehow take the best athletes in the world and you put them on a course that was at sea level in very cold, bright, windless conditions, and perhaps the course wasn't just tarmac, which is what runners normally run on, which is not the quickest or the most conducive surface for running great times. And the idea of having a circuit is partly because it would be tough to lay 26.2 miles of pristine, you know, running surface, but also because it would allow pacemakers to come in and out of the race. So if you run behind a pacemaker or a group of pacemakers for a whole marathon, the benefit to your time is about 100 seconds if you're an elite marathon runner. And at present, pacemakers only go with the athletes to about 30 or 35Ks, you know, 17 miles or something. So what they're doing is they're running the last section of the race on their own, which is how normal marathons are run. But if you really wanted to see what it was possible to run for a whole marathon with that assistance of the pacemakers, you know, you could actually see some massive shavings off the time.
As part of the sub-2-hour marathon project, Yiannis Pitsiladis is developing a new kind of drug testing at the Centre for Anti-Doping Research at the University of Brighton in the UK.
What we've been doing is looking at the molecular signature of some of the drugs that are being taken by the athletes. And what I mean by that is the switching on and switching off of genes. Now, when one takes a drug, there will be a response to that drug even after the drug has left the system. And it's very much trying to identify what are those patterns of those genes that are being switched on and those genes that are being switched off, and developing the pattern that matches to the drug that has been utilized.
So you're really drilling down, you know, say in the case of EPO, like a blood test at the moment is really trying to look for a higher level of red blood cells, yeah, but you're really looking at the gene expression that that drug would produce.
And the problem with the current approaches is that by measuring, let's say, red blood cells, the problem we have there is that if you're looking at the percentage of red blood cells in someone's blood, it can be diluted down to actually cheat the current test. By looking at gene expression, however, that is not amenable to dilution. So basically, by having this approach, by looking at the gene expression, you know, we can beat the cheaters based on molecular signatures. I wasn't around when Sir Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, but you know, we wanted to do something along the same lines and also produce a legacy for future generations. This technology that will be developed, the innovations that will come out of such a project, the better anti-doping tests and approach that will come out of this project, I think will produce a legacy for the future.
Yiannis Pitsiladis is Professor of Sport and Exercise Science at the University of Brighton in the UK. He's the Director of the Centre for Anti-Doping Research there, and he heads up the sub-2-hour marathon project. On RN, on air, online and mobile, you're listening to The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith. The possibility of running a marathon in anything like 2 hours is out of reach for practically all of us, but there are other feats of distance running and world records, such as the one that Tom Dennis pursued. He's a mathematician and oceanographer by profession and a keen amateur runner who set a world record for the fastest run around the globe. How long did it take you, Tom?
622 days, to be precise. A little over 1 year and 8 months.
And how many Ks did you average per day?
Well, I totaled 26,232 kilometres, which is actually the equivalent of exactly 622 marathons. So you could say I averaged a marathon per day, but I did have days off when I was travelling in between continents and a little bit of time at Christmas and so on. So the actual days I ran, I averaged right on 50 kilometres per day.
What qualifies as a run around the world?
There are rules and guidelines, believe it or not. Essentially, what you have to do is run that distance of 26,232 kilometres. You must start and finish at the same point. You must cross 4 continents from one major ocean to another contiguously. In other words, no gaps whatsoever in between. And you must pass through antipodal points. So that's points on opposite sides of the Earth. And for me, that was just near Wellington in New Zealand and just near Madrid in Spain.
All right. So if you'd, yeah, the point is if you'd sort of drilled through the Earth from Wellington,
right,
you'd get to Madrid, more or less.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. And who sets these sorts of rules?
Well, the governing body for this sort of sport is fairly recently established. It's called the World Runners Association.
Well, you describe what you do as journey running. Tell me about what that means, Tom.
Journey running really is just getting out, travelling via foot. It's almost like a holiday on your feet.
You also describe it as comfort running, and that if you're breathing heavily, then you're running too fast. So what's the pace and style of your running?
Well, there's no way you can run, you know, more than a marathon every single day for nearly 2 years if you're not comfortable. For me, it ended up being around about 7.5 minutes per kilometre, which is pretty slow, certainly much slower than I had ever been used to running. And it's probably only about 50% faster than walking. But when you're going at that sustainable pace that you discover for yourself, you can virtually go forever. I didn't need to stop physically. It was more the
stop and have a look around.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm. How old are you, Tom?
I'm now 54, but I started the run just before I turned 51 and finished at the age of 52. So I had 2 birthdays on the road, and it's not very common to say you went for a run and didn't get back until 2 birthdays later.
Indeed. Well, to spend 2 years running around the world, you've of course got to be in a position to be able to do it. For you, your business was under control, your kids were grown up, your wife was amenable, and you had the money. So it was kind of like a 2-year running holiday. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, what sort of toll did running so far for so long end up taking on your body?
Not at all. In fact, I would say I'm healthier now than I ever have been. And a lot of people say, oh, surely your knees are shot. Not true. I have absolutely no pain in them whatsoever. I would say, though, that your muscles do sort of, they slot into a range of movement that when you try to get out of that range, in other words, if you do try to run a bit faster, you sort of can't. Most people in their normal activity, they might run for a bus or have to race up some stairs or something like that. That sort of variety, as little as it may be, keeps your muscles ready to do those sorts of things when it's called upon. But I was finding that doing the one thing and having my legs going through just the same motion all day long, every day, really sort of ended up limiting them to that motion, at least for a couple of months after I finished.
And that's fascinating. It sort of locks you in muscle-wise.
That's right. And I remember once in the US, I think in the state of West Virginia, I wanted to cross a freeway and there was an overhead bridge. And what it meant was, you know, getting up the stairs and across. And I attempted to jog up the stairs. I just couldn't. My legs simply didn't have the specific muscles needed to go upstairs, and I had to just stop and walk up. It was a bit of a concern, but I thought, once I get back and finish.
Well, you're now a member of the World Runners Club. Mm-hmm. How many members does that club have?
Four at the moment, I believe. There are a few other people who I think qualify, but it's required that you submit your full documentation and have that all accepted.
Tom, has doing that run around the world satisfied whatever itch you needed to scratch, or has it just made it worse?
A little bit of both. I'd be quite happy to do it again. If I did, I think I did it in 622 days this time. I could probably knock it about 70 days off, I reckon. I'd bring it down to around 550 this first time with breaks and just travelling, you know, taking more time than I needed in between continents and so on, and a long break over Christmas. And I know I could average more than 50 k's a day. I don't think it would be hard at all to up that average to 55, take a few less days off. It's quite achievable. And a good runner could probably do it in under 500.
Well, whether it's around the world in 500 days or a marathon in 2 hours, if you're more of an armchair athlete, you can read about it. The World at My Feet by Tom Dennis and 2 hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon by Ed Caesar. Details for both on the Bodysphere website. And there's a link there to the website for the sub-2-hour marathon project at abc.net.au/rn. Choose the Bodysphere from the list of programs. And while you're there, do leave a comment if you'd care to. I'm Amanda Smith, and I just want to mention to you another program on RN that's one of my favourites that I think you might like too. It's called Off Track, and it's all about the things people do outdoors. That includes scientists, environmentalists, farmers, as well as outdoor sports and anything really that happens outside. There's always great stories, and it's often surprising where it takes you. So if you haven't already got Off Track as one of your regular downloads, maybe give it a go. That's my recommendation.
The best is to